From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what's the latest in the impassioned debate over Michigan's wolf hunt?
The Humane Society of the United States has poured a lot of money into this hunt. Pro-hunt groups have poured a lot of money into the opposing issue.
What happens when you travel abroad and say, I'm from Detroit?
This time was the first time in 11 years that when I told people I was from Detroit, people said, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that, or it provokes a lot of pity.
A renowned artist helps visually impaired kids discover art has as much to do with the heart as with the eye because he is legally blind.
I know from my experience, the art is one place you can be free.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. A wave of nonprofit community hospitals has been merging with large for-profit healthcare systems over the past 4 years. For-profits promise to bring a significant amount of cash to the smaller hospitals and to the people who live around them. But how will consolidation like this affect what you will pay for healthcare? I'm Cynthia Canty. Also today on Stateside, we'll look at recent hospital acquisitions in Michigan and then meet a renowned artist who is legally blind, who's been helping visually impaired kids in the Detroit area discover that they can make art. As his 15-year involvement with this program comes to an end, we talk with University of Michigan professor Sadashi Inuzuka about the future of these art workshops. But first, new data is out on Michigan's first and very controversial wolf hunting season. MLive.com's John Barnes has dug through the results. John, how many wolves were killed in the hunt?
Well, there were 22 wolves killed. They had hoped to take 43, but they ended up with 11 males and 11 females that hunters were able to take out.
And ages?
The ages ranged. There was a pup that was half a year old to a couple adults, male and female, who were about 7.5 years old. That's getting kind of old for wolf time in the wild.
And when we realized that the DNR was hoping to take 43 wolves and indeed 22 were actually taken, why the disparity? Why was it why did it fall so short?
Well, they wanted a conservative hunt in the first place, and they had 1,200 licenses and just wanted 43 wolves taken. It was a harsh, harsh November, December. There was a lot of snow. There was a lot of wind. They were hoping for collateral hunting of wolves. Deer hunters out there who might take a wolf if they had a license, they fell short of that, probably because they're new to Michigan, probably because it was very limited territory that they could shoot them in, and they fell well half of their goal.
And hunters weren't very happy, were they?
No, most hunters were unhappy. I think 45% said that they thought it was a good hunt or a very good hunt. But they also are learning how to hunt wolves, and in other states in the Great Lakes area, they had 10 times the success. They also allow trapping. They allow other forms of hunting that Michigan does not allow.
Now, John, those who wanted a wolf hunt pointed very often and frequently to livestock attacks as a big reason. What can you tell us about livestock attacks in 23 and as compared to the year before?
In the 3 years that the DNR studied livestock attacks, basically from 2010 to spring of 2013, they had a large number of attacks, part of the peak. One farmer accounted for about half of those attacks, more than 100 cattle killed or attacked. Mr. Koski, John Koski, has a farm in the Upper Peninsula in Onondagan County, and he's been criticized for not having great animal husbandry techniques.
And he actually was charged with animal cruelty or neglect, wasn't he?
He was. The state provided him what they call guard donkeys, which have a powerful kick and deter wolves, and two of those animals died on John's farm, and one had to be removed because the state said it wasn't taken care of. That's what the prosecutor charged him with, animal neglect and cruelty.
And there were some other accusations, weren't there?
He was accused of leaving cattle on the farm that were dead. I visited his farm on 2 days and saw evidence of bones of cattle, a carcass of a cattle, and deer legs in a pickup bed of a truck that hunters were using to bait wolves. So certainly there were wolves that knew that there was food there, mm-hmm. and maybe generations of wolves.
Mm-hmm. And his farm, that farm now in Onondaga County, is for sale, isn't it?
He is. He has put it up for sale. He told me that last year that he was going to. He actually has done that, and he has removed the cattle from the property. Some he moved into a neighboring farm that he owns in Gogebic County, and the rest he has sold.
And what about the animal cruelty charges?
Well, those, John is going to, as my understanding is, they have negotiated a plea. John will plead on Thursday. There is not a lot of information on what the reduced charge will be, but the goal is to keep Mr. Koski out of jail. He's 69 years old.
But looking at 2013 with 13 wolf attacks documented and that, and the year before was 64, what do critics of the hunt say about this?
Critics say that the reduced number of attacks is evidence that non-hunting measures are working. In recent years, lethal methods of taking out problem wolves have been approved, and farmers have been able to do that. There's also other non-lethal methods that have been implemented that scare away wolves. And they would say that 2013 is evidence that the hunt that happened in November was not necessary.
Mm. If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with MLive reporter John Barnes, who looked at the impact of the Michigan wolf hunt in a recent piece for MLive. John, what might we be seeing in terms of ballot questions this November, pro and con, about the wolf hunt?
It's extremely complicated, Cynthia. There will be one ballot question for sure, and lawmakers bypassed that. They passed another measure that would make that moot for the most part by giving the hunt responsibility to the Natural Resources Commission.
Okay.
The anti-hunt people had a second petition referendum that is expected to get approved tomorrow when the State Board of Canvassers meet to substantiate the petitions. The pro-hunt people have since begun a petition referendum that would make all of that moot if it gets approved and the legislature acts. And if the legislature does not act on that, you could have three ballot proposals in November on wolf hunts. Very confusing.
Oh, and a lot of money is flying around on both sides, isn't it?
Almost $2 million. That's about a little more than $2,000 per wolf in Michigan. The Humane Society of the United States has poured a lot of money into this hunt. Pro-hunt groups like the Michigan United Conservation Clubs and the Houndsman Clubs and the Bear Hunting Clubs have poured a lot of money into the opposing issue. And it's only going to become more expensive as we move forward.
Now, does the DNR have plans firmed up for a second wolf hunt?
Well, they're planning, but they're planning with sort of their one hand, one arm tied behind their back. They don't know what's going to go on the ballot. If some of these measures get on there, they can't have a hunt. They'll have to postpone it. But right now they're looking at the data that we discussed and making plans. And DNR could say, no, we're good. We're not going to hunt anymore. We took care of our problem. Or they could say we're going to expand it substantially.
So just kind of recap for us then, John, what should we watch for? What's coming up next?
I would watch for tomorrow whether or not the second referendum gets approved by the State Board of Canvassers. Mr. Koski's sentencing on Thursday, actually his plea, is interesting, but it's almost a side issue to this. We will move forward regardless of what happens with that. And then the big thing will be whether the legislature this summer, in an election year, decides whether to approve a referendum that makes everything else irrelevant.
Big, big issue, and boy, a lot of passions involved in it. John Barnes, MLive reporter, bringing us up to date as figures come in and information is digested. I know there was a big presentation made recently to the Michigan Wolf Management Advisory Council, and we know we'll be hearing a lot more about this issue. John, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Even before Detroit got itself an emergency manager and became the biggest city in American history to declare bankruptcy, the headlines, the images coming out of the Motor City have been pretty grim. And as travelers abroad are discovering, that has led to all kinds of interesting encounters with the locals when they find out you're from Detroit. So do you tell them I'm from Detroit or hide it? That's the question posed by my next guest, Detroit Free Press travel writer Ellen Krieger. So there you were, Ellen, traveling around Ireland. And I know from going there for more than 40 years, the Irish will always ask a Yank where he or she is from. They figure they might have a relative or a friend who emigrated to your town. And of course, you would know him or her. So how did things go for you on your Irish trip?
Well, you know, the Irish are very, you're right, they, most of them have a relative, a friend, a relative of a friend
yes.
in the United States, and they do have a pretty good grasp of geography in the United States, and they've heard of most of the cities, but it is the concept of what they know about every city is a little bit different than we would have back at home.
So when you said, as we all, so many of us do from Michigan, you go, I'm from Detroit, because you figure people kind of get that. What kind of responses did you get?
I've been the travel writer for 11 years, and I've traveled all over the world, and I almost always tell people I'm from Detroit. I live in the suburbs of Detroit, but Detroit is sort of a geographical shorthand because people around the world have heard of our city.
Right.
But this time was the first time in 11 years that when I told people I was from Detroit, people said, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that, or it provoked a lot of pity and sympathy and worry on the behalf of the people who I talk to.
Really? And what kind of impressions were you gathering that they had about Detroit, and how different were those impressions from real life in Detroit?
One of the people I talked to, they did have a friend of a relative who lives in Detroit. So they actually had quite a level of information about the bankruptcy, about the problems of the auto industry. But her conclusion was, because we're in bankruptcy, the auto industry is destroyed, and therefore Detroit is a ruin. And the problem is, when you're traveling, you don't want to spend a lot of time explaining things or getting into arguments or getting into political discussions. So it makes it real pretty difficult. So I just did a lot of sighing and keeping my mouth shut and trying to quietly say it's not quite like that, or things are looking up, or I'm proud to be from Detroit. But it was very difficult this time.
So what you found is that all the headlines about Detroit's troubles have drowned out that cool image as Motown or the Motor City. So now it's no longer the city put the world on wheels. It's broke, busted Detroit. So you decided to try I'm from Michigan, and how did responses change?
Well, I tried. I'm from Michigan. That's in the north of the country, and we have a lot of snow. Well, that was a good answer, because people, then they talk about the weather, and they talk about their weather. And, of course, all weather is local, and they just had a lot of storms in Ireland.
Yes.
So we talked about the weather. That avoids the topic, but I didn't feel quite comfortable with that.
You know, it's interesting. I found over the years, because we have family in County Cork, we are there every single year and sometimes more than once a year. And then we'll travel up the west. And I can remember being in a tiny, tiny town in County Galway, out in Connemara, where Irish is spoken here, English is understood. And teenagers would get excited when they found out I was from Detroit, because they knew that's where Eminem was from or Kid Rock was from Detroit. But it kind of sounds like in that time, sadly, the bankruptcy headlines have kind of tanked the cool image.
You know, I think that because the news of the bankruptcy has been on the front pages or on TV around the world. So if you're traveling in the United States, it's a little bit different. People know Detroit for its sports teams, its music, good entertainment. You know, people can see a little more complex picture of Detroit. But abroad, there's more of a single message that's getting out. So it used to be Detroit's the Motor City. That's where they make the cars. That's what I used to get a lot. You know, about the Motor City and the cars. People did hear before about maybe the crime of Detroit or the cool of Detroit or Motown. But now everyone has seen those bankruptcy pictures, those what they call ruin porn, the pictures of all the broken down buildings. And it's really hard to convince people otherwise.
Although I will say, I think that, it's a two-way street there, because how many American travelers come over to Ireland expecting people to have red hair, freckles, and talk like Barry Fitzgerald and say top of the morning to you, and the Irish kind of gag.
That's right, exactly.
They're like,
and there is a simplification of people's expectations wherever you go. That's right.
Yeah, very true. So have you decided going forward, are you from Detroit or are you from Michigan, or are you kind of sort of in the middle?
I will probably still tell people I'm from Detroit when I travel around the world. But I think what I was trying to do with a column is less trying to change people's minds around the world and defend how great Detroit is, because we do have a lot of problems. I think I was trying to tell people here how much every single thing you say or do is broadcast around the world. I mean, the funniest part is when I was in Ennis, Ireland, this guy wouldn't talk about the bankruptcy. He got worried because when I told him I was from Detroit, he said, I watch a TV show set in Detroit. It's called Hardcore Pawn.
Oh, dear Lord.
And he said, that does not reflect well on your city. Hmm. And it looks pretty rough there. And I could not defend Hardcore Pawn. It is. It's a horrible show. And a lot of these worst, most horrible TV shows that run in the United States are running all over the world. And people think that United States is like Hardcore Pawn. It's like Duck Dynasty. It's like Honey Boo Boo. It's frightening. You know, one other thing I would like your listeners to think about is how it can hurt people's feelings and good etiquette about traveling. I would never criticize someone's home. If someone said, I'm from Cairo, actually Egypt is one of my favorite places, but I might say the worried thing. I might say, are you okay? Is your family okay back in Cairo? Which may be sort of insulting to them. I would never say, I hear that it's a pit or it's destroyed because of the violence there. I would never say that. And so I am kind of shocked sometimes when I travel in the world and people tell me things so critical about my home. And I just think it's bad etiquette.
It was an interesting piece. It was in the Sunday Free Press a couple weeks back. You can easily find it online. Ellen Krieger, good talking with you. We will look for you, your travel column in the Sunday Free Press. As always, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Okay, thanks, Cynthia.
It all began 15 years ago as a series of annual workshops for K through 12 students, kids who were blind and visually impaired. The goal? To introduce them to art and help them experience the joy of creating art. Bringing the low vision and sighted communities was the idea of internationally renowned ceramic artist Sadashi Inuzuka. He's the Arthur Thurnau Professor at the Penny W. Stamps School of Art and Design at the University of Michigan. Welcome, Sadashi.
Thank you.
Well, you were born and you grew up in Japan, and you were declared legally blind and discouraged from pursuing your love of the arts, but you didn't let the word no stop you.
Well, it was hard. Japan is a very different situation, and I find out very early on that my sight is not good. It was very difficult to pursue study or even, of course, art. And at that time, in Japan, I don't know here in the States, but you are either blind or sighted. So a person like me, visually impaired, fall into the crack. So that was kind of a very difficult situation.
And yet your heart told you that you were drawn to art.
Art was escape, only place I felt safe and I can be who I am. So that's why I just, more than passion was a necessity.
Hmm. That's what you hear so often from musicians and artists, that this is just, I have to do this like I would breathe. And you didn't let that word no keep you from becoming an artist and then a professor of art at the University of Michigan. And I wondered how your visual challenges played a role in the kind of art that you produce. Certainly you work, you're known for your work in clay and ceramics.
Of course, it makes sense to work with clay because of my visual impairment. But often those are people who has visual impairment or blind. You kind of compensate with some other skills, tools, we say. Some cognitively and some using other senses. And we all have those senses, but once you don't have, then other senses is more acute, become acute. So how I see things probably are very different from people who are sighted. Often I imagine a lot. So your face, I cannot see very well, but I deconstruct your faces with my kind of a brain.
All right.
Because I know who you are and I know your kind of a feeling of who you are, then I can really reconstruct your face. And you look very beautiful, so.
Oh, thank you. And you're able to use those skills to create the ceramic pieces that are so well known and renowned.
Oh, thank you.
And then you wanted to try to open the minds of youngsters who are blind and visually impaired and expose them to the joy you've found in art.
Right, right. I think mostly I teach. Well, I don't teach, but we do workshop together with people with disability, especially in Detroit, children. And they are coming from very difficult circumstances at home. And also they have a visual impairment or blind. And I thought, I know from my experience, the art is one place you can be free.
And safe.
Safe. So I wanted to give them the same thing I had, and then helped me a lot. And so that's my motivation. But before that, I was hiding my visual impairment a long time because I didn't want people to label me as artist with a disability. I wanted to be an artist. But that was 1998. One of exchange students from Japan gave me a book. The book is about blind children's artwork written by an art teacher at the blind school in Japan. And I read through very quickly and I burst in tears because I felt ashamed because I was hiding my visual impairment. And then reading that book, how beautiful those children are and how capable and how able those children are. And I have nothing to hide because I'm visually impaired. So since then, my attitude changed.
And you wanted to spread that with these children you've been working with over the years.
I wanted to share everything.
I'm speaking with Sadashi Inozuka, who is a professor at the Penny W. Stamp School of Art and Design at the University of Michigan, who, as someone who is visually impaired, has made a renowned career for himself as an artist and has been sharing that joy with children all over Southeast Michigan who come to these workshops. And what have you seen happen? Not only for the children who come to the workshops, but for the University of Michigan art and design students who come and work with them. So you have a meeting of these two groups. What have you seen happen that has made you feel glad?
Well, through the semester, our student, UofM student, attitude changes, gradually changes, and open their eyes. Because everybody has an assumption.
Absolutely.
You go in there. And most of the students think, they are very wonderful students I have. They think they are so eager to help the blind children. You know, they came into that attitude.
Yeah.
And so of course, they are helping them. But slowly, slowly, they realize they don't need a help. And in the end, and they realized they were helped by those children. Because children opens you up. For the creator or artist, any art, any creative field, you have to be open, open-minded. And assumption is the worst enemy for us. So it's humbling experience because our assumption about, oh, poor blind children in Detroit, that's all gone. Yeah.
But now you're retiring. You're about ready to wrap up your career at the University of Michigan, yeah, as well as the workshops. How does that feel to you?
Ooh, I would like to keep this workshop. And then I'm talking to a Stump School that, is there any way we can keep this relationship between Detroit Public School children with blind and visually impairment? But it's unknown. Future is unknown.
What's going to be next for you now that you're retiring?
I had a dream a long time to start up the retreat for artists or retreat for people who have a creative mind. Because our life is, we think a lot, but we always reactive thinking, so busy. But we never really think more reflectively. And my wife and I are going to start the artist retreat in British Columbia in Canada. We're going to have some land in the small island called Cortez Island in British Columbia. And we're going to start the place, and anyone can welcome. But I don't want people to bring all those everyday life into that.
Leave it at the door.
No cell phone.
No cell phones.
No computers.
No internet, yes.
And also my dream is someday I would like to invite Detroit children to bring their. It's a beautiful place. They can touch the starfish, and they can pick up the oysters. And I'm start thinking about so many things they can do. And that's my dream. And then I would like to start something new.
It's time.
It's time.
At the same time, your heart is with these youngsters that have been in the workshop. So we will have to follow through and see, because at this point, as you say, after that summer workshop, the future is uncertain.
Right.
Sadashi Inuzuka, retiring as professor at the Penny W. Stamp School of Art and Design at the University of Michigan. It has been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. For-profit healthcare systems taking over smaller community hospitals. It's become a distinct healthcare trend in our state. And it raises questions. Is this a way for a small community hospital to stay alive, expand, maybe modernize? Or is it a trend where bottom-line thinking will affect patient costs and quality of care? Writer Julie Edgar is with Bridge Magazine. Good to have you on the program, Julie.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, how much consolidation have we seen so far in Michigan? I'm wondering when this started taking off.
Well, really since 2010, there has been a lot of merger activity in Michigan, but Michigan sort of lagged behind other states where mergers and acquisitions have been, you know, the norm for the last, say, 10 years or so. Really, it started in the 1990s. But in Michigan, there's been a lot of activity in the last 4 years or so.
And what's behind that? What kind of got things launched off in 2010?
Well, declining reimbursements really have driven a lot of the merger activity. So hospitals rely on Medicare and Medicaid payments, Medicare primarily, because it serves an older population. When the federal government started cutting the budget, hospitals started to suffer. That's sort of one factor in the trend. And also, nowadays, healthcare really is sort of performed more on an outpatient basis. There are fewer hospitalizations. Occupancy rates at hospitals are low-ish. Mm-hmm. Let's put it this way. They're nowhere near 100%. And So you've got a trend toward outpatient care, even of older adults. So there's not as much a need for acute facilities.
So that turns up the economic pressure, if you will, under these community hospitals.
Turns up a lot of pressure. Plus, they've got infrastructure needs, and it's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So in record keeping, just in that one area alone, they need the technology to make it happen. They've got to meet federal mandates. The Affordable Care Act carries new requirements for healthcare institutions in general. So these standalone hospitals, they just can't afford it. Teaming up or becoming part of a larger system, well, it brings economies of scale. So it makes sense for them.
Give us an idea of some of the standalone hospitals that we're talking about, ones that have been taken over by these larger systems. For example,
let's look at Northern Michigan Hospital in Petoskey, which is tertiary care, so they offer specialized care. You know, on the larger side, and it was taken over by McLaren.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a standalone, you know, again, a nonprofit. McLaren, by the way, is also a nonprofit, and
right.
That's more of the norm, by the way, for nonprofits to take over. So that was a standalone hospital that went with McLaren because McLaren has a lot of buying power. It can make improvements that Northern Michigan decided it couldn't do on its own. They have an outdated plant. McLaren's going to invest. So you've got these hospitals that really just, I'm assuming they could survive, but they have a much better chance if they're part of a larger system.
Let's talk about what you found as you study these consolidations and you talk to people involved. What have you found that turned out well?
You know, it's hard to say because so many of these acquisitions are new. I did talk a little bit. I went to somebody over at Northern Michigan and mm-hmm. asked the question, what has changed? What have you noticed?
Mm-hmm.
And the response was, you know, not much. You know, they sort of build differently, but it doesn't feel that much different. I talked to Sheila Kahn Monroe. She is an attorney for the Michigan Nurses Association.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked her, what about contract negotiations? What have you found now that these hospitals have become part of larger systems? And interestingly, she said the negotiations with Duke LifePoint, which is a for-profit that took over Marquette General,
mm-hmm.
bought Marquette General, were actually better than they were with McLaren, a nonprofit that has taken over several small hospitals in Michigan. So I found that kind of interesting that there's a perception that for-profits are more financially cutthroat, that they increase their profits by cutting staff. And she said, actually, you know, we had made some staffing ratio demands that they met. Now, this is the beginning.
Sure.
You know, who knows what the future is going to bring. But yeah, I mean, there's some sense that maybe, you know, everybody's interested in maximizing profits. And they do that on the backs of workers. So there's some sense that these mergers have resulted in economies of scale, that they're better for, certainly for the hospital systems themselves. There's a sense that there are certain services that for-profits will cut because they're not profitable, whereas nonprofits are likelier to maintain these sorts of programs.
But can we jump in and say, if I've got a small standalone hospital, you had mentioned Petoskey, when it becomes part of McLaren, do I start seeing modernized equipment, and do I now have access to more cutting-edge technology and medical treatments than I might have had before? So would that not be good for patients?
Yes, and that point has been made in the literature that when you have the money to invest, ultimately patients will benefit because they'll benefit by having more up-to-date equipment, better diagnostic equipment, and bigger hospital systems have better access to the best physicians.
More resources, sure.
And people don't want to really accept that that's the case, but doctors also go where the money is.
I'm speaking with writer Julie Edgar, who took a look at the trend of larger health systems gobbling up smaller standalone hospitals throughout Michigan. And as you looked at this for Bridge, Julie, how do you find that this trend is affecting costs of services at the former community hospitals?
Well, so the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and I mentioned this in the Bridge story, has been doing an ongoing they've been reviewing studies that have been going on since 2006 of both quality of care and cost of care after mergers, hospital mergers.
Mm-hmm.
What they found is overall costs do rise once hospitals are sort of, they become part of a more concentrated system. So what they found is in markets where there are only one or two systems, costs do go up, and they found that in some cases they go up 20%. It happens particularly in the year or two after the acquisition. So, of course, when costs go up, well, insurers tend to pass those on to consumers in the form of higher premiums.
You did also note in your story for Bridge that in the local communities, by and large, it seems like there was a fair amount of enthusiasm from people, perhaps more enthusiasm and less suspicion about this trend.
Well, in Marquette, mm-hmm. which is really a dramatic example
mm-hmm.
of a merger or acquisition, it seemed to happen without a whole lot of fuss. They had community forums, and there was some concern about a hospital having monopoly on health care. Duke LifePoint is a joint venture between LifePoint, which is a hospital company or a health care company, and Duke, which is part of Duke University's mm-hmm. health system. But LifePoint also took over two small community hospitals, basically in the wake of the Marquette acquisition. So there were some concerns about monopoly, that LifePoint now owns so much of the healthcare market in the UP that you don't have a choice. Consumers just don't have a choice. It's kind of like, you know, used to be that we could go to our corner hardware store, right, for nails and duct tape. Well, now
we have to go to the big box store.
Yes, I mean, you go to Home Depot or Lowe's.
Sure.
It's sort of similar. I mean, you know, I think a lot more complex because you're talking about people, you're talking about patient care, but I think that we can sort of look at it that way, that it's not a bad analogy, that now you've got one company that basically owns all of the healthcare institutions in the north central part of the UP.
Well, could one make the case that all of this is kind of echoes Darwin's theory of evolution with survival of the fittest? I mean, you think of today's healthcare world. Are these smaller standalone community hospitals forced to go the way of the GP who used to make house calls? That doesn't happen anymore. That these consolidations of themselves aren't inherently good or bad. They just are?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's my opinion. I mean, I feel like it's not good or bad because there's good and there's bad
mm-hmm.
points. But the American Hospital Association says that only about 12% of community hospitals are part of larger systems at this point. They've come out with some research that shows that, indeed, you know, it's not as bad as we think, you know, that there are lots of community hospitals, that only about 600 hospitals have been involved in a merger or acquisition between 2007 and 2013. So they're making the argument that, oh, there are still lots of community hospitals out there. And that may be so, but I think you're right. I think that's another very good way of looking at it, that this is just the evolution of the healthcare industry. Hospitals rely on the federal government for reimbursement. When the federal government pulls back, well, then they've got to respond. So I think that's driving it. And so I asked the question to the LifePoint, a LifePoint CEO who worked on this merger, this acquisition. And I said, so if reimbursements are down, if you're not getting patient volumes anymore, why buy a hospital? And not only why buy a hospital, but why invest in a brand new facility? They're scouting sites now mm-hmm. to build a new hospital.
In Marquette?
In Marquette. And he said, well, because the population's aging. And the fact is that as people get older, and in Michigan our population is old, they're going to need hospitals. So, in other words, yeah, right this moment, we have, you know, low occupancy, lower patient volumes, but it's not always going to be that way. And I think that's also driving, demographics drive another trend, which is hospitals acquiring long-term care facilities.
Planning ahead and watching us age.
Well, yeah, I think Michigan is just behind Florida in the percentage of its population that's over the age of 65. And so I think maybe Michigan is now kind of ripe for this kind of activity, you know, the merger and acquisition activity.
Julie Edgar's look at community hospitals and for-profits, larger groups gobbling them up, can be found in Bridge Magazine. Julie, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much, Cindy. I appreciate it.
If you've been wondering why your favorite pine tree has been turning brown or orange as the weather warms up, well, blame winter.
We're seeing a lot of winter injury on our conifers. The typical scenario is we get browning either on the entire tree, oftentimes maybe on one side or the other. And so that's certainly gotten a lot of people's attention.
Bert Craig is an associate professor in the horticulture department at Michigan State University. Is this also happening in evergreen trees and shrubs? And I'm going to ask you this because if my favorite big arborvitae shrub in front of my house is this weird mix of mainly orangey brown and some green, was that the winter?
Yeah, probably. Now, there's other things that could be going on, but it's a good likelihood, especially if it's any kind of exposed location.
Sure.
And it looked fine going into the winter, then, yeah, that's probably what you're seeing. And the main thing we try to get across to people at this point, at least, is, you know, don't panic. Because what happens a lot of times with these conifers is that even though the foliage may be damaged, the buds are still okay. And so the best advice we can really give at this point is kind of wait and see, because oftentimes these things, even on some trees that, you know, look pretty bad and pretty brown, if you actually go in there and were to look at the buds, the terminal buds or the buds along the stem, and you can pull the little cap off, the bud scales off, and look inside there, the bud itself is still green. And these will flush out, and you'll get a new set of needles, new flush of growth. And over time, that will cover up essentially those brown needles. Now, in some cases, the buds are killed, and that's where I think, you know, some of our severe cold really took its toll.
So it sounds like you're saying be patient. I'm wondering how long does it take? Will we have a summer of them looking a little off, and by next year they'll look better? Or what time are we talking about?
Yeah, it really depends on the situation. If it's something where the needles have been killed, you know, or mm-hmm. brown, but the buds are okay, probably even by this summer things will start to look pretty normal. You should know probably by the middle to end of June, if those things have not flushed at all and you're not seeing any new growth, you're probably looking at a tree that's not going to make it.
Bert, is there any TLC that a homeowner can give to a stressed or injured tree, or should we just let Mother Nature take care of it?
I would say for the most part, it's let Mother Nature take its course. Now, the key would be as we get later into the year. So if you have a tree that, say, had some significant winter burn, you know, a third, two-thirds of the tree was, you know, the needles were brown, and it's flushing, and it looks like it's putting on some new growth okay. The key then would be later on this summer, if we get into, you know, a prolonged dry period, say in July and August, where we have, and we can get, you know, 6 weeks or so where we really haven't any rain, you want to make sure you're getting that tree a good drink, probably once a week or so, to prevent any additional stresses. And that would really be the key thing there. You want to be careful not to overcompensate, because it can kill with kindness here too. So
yeah.
I think best let it take its course. And then the idea is just to minimize any further stress on the tree.
Good advice from Bert Craig, who's an associate professor in the horticulture department at Michigan State University. And I'm going to take your advice and be patient and just send some healing thoughts to my sad-looking orangey arborvitae at the front door.
Yeah, that's the best advice. And, you know, don't panic and let it take its course there.
Thanks so much for talking with us on Stateside, Bert.
You're welcome.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Omar Sadeh, Katie Suha, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.